This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Defense and foreign ministers from the U.S. who arrived in Japan late Monday were tasked to discuss their concern over China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific region as the Biden administration tries to reaffirm engagement with its key regional allies. The priority Tuesday for U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken was to hold so-called 2+2 security talks with their Japanese counterparts. President Joe Biden's decision to send his key ministers to Japan as their first overseas visit rather than hosting Japanese officials in Washington is said to mean a lot for Japan, which considers its alliance with the U.S. the cornerstone of its diplomatic and security policies. The World Health Organization on Monday urged countries not to panic as several nations halted the use of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. The WHO appealed to countries not to suspend vaccination against a disease that has caused more than 2.7 million deaths worldwide. The WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said systems were in place to protect public health. Portugal joined Spain, France, Germany, Italy, Denmark, Norway, and several other countries in halting the use of the AstraZeneca jab amid concerns over possible serious side effects. The WHO said that there was no evidence that the incidents are caused by the vaccine developed by AstraZeneca, an Anglo-Swedish company with Oxford University. The EU's EMA medicines regulator said would meet on Thursday to analyze the situation and reaffirmed its view that the benefits of the drug outweigh the risks. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Facebook is now adding more labeling to posts about coronavirus vaccines as it works to combat misinformation. We get more details from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Facebook and Instagram have been criticized for allowing anti-vaccination propaganda to spread. So CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced that they're adding labels with information from the World Health Organization. One example he gives is if there's a discussion on the safety of COVID vaccines, they'll add a note that the vaccines are tested for safety and effectiveness before they're approved. But the Center for Countering Digital Hate says that's not enough. Facebook needs to take down threads with misinformation. I'm Jackie Quinn.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson says his comments about the Capitol breach last week were not racist. AP correspondent Mike Rossi gives us background.
Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin is pushing back on criticism of his comments last week that he wasn't concerned about the pro-Trump mob at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, but would have been if they were Black Lives Matter protesters.
There's nothing racial in my comments whatsoever.
Speaking to reporters at the Capitol Monday, Johnson said there were only a few bad apples in the crowd.
The vast majority of people that attend Trump rallies, that I'm assuming the same people over here, they love law enforcement. They never even think of them. I mean, they're not rioters.
More than 300 Trump supporters have been charged in the storming of the Capitol. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. air travel is rising to the highest levels yet since the pandemic hit. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
The TSA screened more than 1.3 million people both Friday and Sunday, setting a new high since the coronavirus outbreak devastated travel a year ago. Airlines believe the numbers are heading up with more people booking flights for spring and summer. However, there's still a long way to go. While the number of people passing through airport checkpoints on Sunday finally eclipsed the number on the same day last year, it was still down by some 45% from the same day 2 years ago. Since the pandemic hit, air travel has picked up a few times, mostly around holidays, only to drop back down. I'm Shelley Adler.
Martial law has been declared in a wide area of Myanmar's largest city because of the ruling junta. Security forces killed dozens of protesters over the weekend in an increasingly lethal crackdown on resistance to last month's military coup. The United Nations said that at least 138 peaceful protesters have been killed in Myanmar since the February 1st military coup. That includes at least 56 people killed over this past weekend. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobby Wine was briefly detained after leading street protests.
The opposition have been again planning that they will stop the swearing, you know, the president. They won't, because anybody who's planning that is criminal. The security forces will go for him or her.
Tanzania's vice president implies President Magufuli is sick, but says nothing about coronavirus rumors. South Sudan is ready to prosecute alleged perpetrators of violence, but it must know who they are. Calm returns to a Gambian fishing village after rioters destroy a Chinese fish meal factory. And Kenya was a no-show at the International Court of Justice on Monday.
One of the agreements to avoid this kind of border and boundary disputes was that all member countries shall adhere to all the protocols that they inherited from their respective colonial masters.
And Ivory Coast begins 7 days of mourning for late Prime Minister Hamid Bakayoko. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police on Monday briefly detained opposition leader Bobby Wine as he led opposition lawmakers and supporters in a demonstration. Wine's National Unity Platform Party was protesting the arrest and disappearance of hundreds of supporters. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
At midday and a scorching heat in downtown Kampala, Bobby Wine, together with a few legislators and supporters, began marching to protest the alleged abduction, torture, and murder of his supporters. Wine and his National Unity Platform Party say more than 600 of their supporters are missing and are demanding they be released unconditionally or be produced in court if they are facing charges. The party says three other NUP supporters were murdered in the run-up to this year's elections. Authorities said the deaths were accidental. Elbows intertwined Monday as the marchers moved towards the Constitutional Square and crowds gathered upon seeing the musician turned politician, whose real name is Robert Chagurani. Confronted by the police, Wine and his team raised placards calling for the release of their arrested colleagues. Together with the crowds, they chanted their message before police moved in to arrest Wine. Kampala Metropolitan Deputy Police Spokesperson Lucas Owoyesigiri spoke to VOA.
Him and a few people decided to have a procession that was, of course, illegal. They were briefly detained and later on taken to their homes of residence. They've just arrived here, so let them be patient. We shall leave the places when you feel like everything is normal.
After Wine's brief arrest, the police used tear gas and fired bullets into the air to disperse the growing crowds around the central police station. The army's anti-terrorism unit drove around some city spots with other military officers doing foot patrols. On Sunday night, President Museveni accused the NUP of massively cheating, intimidating voters, and attacking members of the president's National Resistance Movement Party during the January 14th elections. He also accused the party of attempting to disrupt his inauguration.
The opposition have been again planning that they will stop the swearing, you know, the president. They won't, because anybody who is planning that is criminal. The security forces will go for him or her.
David Louis Rubongoya, the National Unity Platform Secretary General, refutes these allegations.
It's laughable. Museveni is very, very hypocritical. How can he even say such a thing? You heard him say that we rigged the election. Certainly, there holds no water whatsoever.
The NUP has previously accused Museveni of rigging the presidential vote to ensure re-election and extend his 35-year stay in power. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Kenya was a no-show at the beginning yesterday of the virtual week-long hearing at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, in The Hague. In a letter to the court, Kenya's Attorney General, Kihara Kairuki, said Kenya was not participating because COVID-19 pandemic conditions hinder its ability to adequately prepare for the hearing. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Somalia had petitioned the court to determine which country should have control over a large Indian Ocean zone that is rich in fish and may contain substantial crude oil reserves.
In a letter to the International Court of Justice, Kenya's Attorney General Kehara Kariuki said that Kenya shall not be participating in the case hearing over the Kenya-Somalia-Indian Ocean Zone dispute that is scheduled for hearing from March 15th to 24th. Mr. Kariuki said that holding the ICJ hearings virtually will not allow Kenya to present its case in the most effective way, and instead requested the court to grant Kenya 30 minutes to address the judges on why it will not participate in the case, a move the court rejected. Ambassador David Kikaya said that if the dispute case is determined following the historical evidence on border land partitioning, then chances are high Kenya will win the contested land.
The map that Kenya was seeking to present reinforces the argument I had advanced earlier of adhering to historical boundaries set during the partition of Africa way back. And that notwithstanding, I think the production of that map will add impetus to the evidence that needs to be looked at.
Kenya has written to the ICJ three times postponing case hearing, a move that saw its fourth time request to postpone rejected after declaring their interest to attend the hearing in person, regardless of contesting the ICJ's authority to rule in the case. Ambassador Kikaya said the long-term dispute between the two countries escalated after Somalia refused to uphold the agreement on the memorandum of understanding.
Somalia chose to delete a seven-sentence word, which I can quote, read, shall enter into force upon its signature. And the relevant ministers, both from Somalia and Kenya, had duly signed. One of the agreements to avoid this kind of border and boundary disputes was that all member countries shall adhere to all the protocols that they inherited from their respective colonial masters.
Representing Somalia at the ICJ proceedings on Monday, Professor Felipe Sands said that Kenya's argument on the ownership of the land in the ocean is hopeless.
Kenya's acquiescence argument is totally unsupported by the facts on the record. The argument is contradicted by Kenya's own acts in a variety of international fora, including before this court just 4 years ago. It's contradicted by the bilateral negotiations with Somalia in the binding treaty between the parties. It is contradicted in the words of its own government, and it is contradicted by the terms of its own domestic maritime legislation. Kenya's argument is, if I may use a single word, hopeless, or if I use two words, totally hopeless.
The international relations expert Dr. Duncan Ojuang says the failure of Kenya to participate in the initial stages of the case has no effect, since countries leave this to be decided on case to base. He says Kenya is concerned about the judge of the ruling court being a Somali and that he might rule in defense of Somalia. Kenya had earlier accused Somalia of selling oil and gas blocks at a London auction, as Somalia also accused Kenya of interfering with its sovereign affairs, despite the pending case before the International Court of Justice. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli has remained out of sight since late February amid rumors that he has COVID-19. Officials have insisted he is well, but the country's vice president said Monday it is normal for people to get sick. She asked Tanzanians to ignore outside information that may cause confusion. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking in the northeastern town of Tanga at the launch of a government project, Tanzania's Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan made comments that seemed to refer to President John Magufuli without mentioning him by name. I want to confirm to you, Tanzania is safe. It is normal for a human being to undergo checkups like flu and fever and could suffer other illnesses. I want to plead with Tanzanians, if there was a time to hold together, it's now, she says. This is the time to build unity. It is not a time to listen to information coming from outside. Tanzanian authorities have come under pressure to reveal Magufuli's health status after some people, including opposition politicians, said he was sick with coronavirus. The president has not been seen in public since February 27th, and several media reports said he was taken abroad for treatment. Since the worldwide pandemic began a year ago, Magufuli has either denied the virus is present in Tanzania or said it can be defeated with steam inhalation and prayer. Philbert Kumu is a political commentator and teaches philosophy at the University of Dar es Salaam. He says the vice president is trying to keep Tanzanians calm.
Her comments seem to be normal to me. For someone to be sick with flu or coughing, it should be a very normal thing to us, and it shouldn't bring too much chaos and uprise in a state like Tanzania. I really believe that she wanted to deliver a message that she has not clearly really wanted to say.
On Friday, Prime Minister Kassim Majaliwa refuted claims the president was sick, saying he was well and working. Anspat Ngumu is a Tanzanian journalist in exile who runs an online news website, Sauti Kubwa, meaning loud voice. He says Tanzanian government officials tend to hide the health status of government officials.
From the look of things, if we don't provoke them, if we don't keep asking questions, they'll never tell us in time. In the most recent events from the State House, when Ambassador John Jazzy, Magufuli's top aide in the State House, we never knew he was sick until they told us he's dead. So they're not in position to tell us what is happening now. They're just waiting to tell us the eventuality of what is happening, if he's dead or if he finally recovers from wherever he was.
Tanzania stopped recording COVID-19 positive cases just a few weeks after announcing its first case in March 2020. After months of downplaying the virus effect recently, government officials called on the population to take precautions and wear masks. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 16. A spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says the South Sudan government is willing and ready to prosecute any government official or military personnel who may have been involved in the wave of attacks a year ago in Jonglei in the Greater Pibor administrative area. But Atain Wekatain says the United Nations must first identify the officials involved. In a new report released on Monday, the UN urged South Sudan's government to hold accountable the military and political figures who it said are supporting community-based militias. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet said the risk that these community-based militias will reignite armed violence is too grave to ignore. However, Wekatin says the UN must release the names of the alleged perpetrators.
We don't have any clue that will give rise to which military leader among the sons and daughters of Jonglei states that are involved in the communal conflict. We don't have the clue. So we need United Nations to provide us the clue, the names, the generals, and the military leaders that are actually found to be involved in Jonglei's communal conflict, and the government will take them to account accordingly. But if we are not given list, the accusation will be vague because there are no names of people provided.
It says here, in addition, members of government and opposition forces actively participated in the fighting. Did the government forces participate?
That's it. This has been the language of whatever report that is being written about South Sudan. People accused and they specified on military and militia leaders, which are not particularly alluded to, so that any reasonable person that come across the news about who is involved in the Jonglei communal fighting exactly know the writer of the report exactly know what he or she is writing about. But the same language, accusing people who are not specified, will not take us anywhere because this is not helpful at all. It is either you give us the names or you don't write a report of such kind because it's not helpful. When a report is not specifying the people who are found to be involved, then that report is as good as something which is not existent completely.
I guess they want your government to do something because, as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, said, the risk that these community-based militias will ignite another violence is too grave to ignore.
Whoever has not been brought to book, then he has not been named, or nobody knows. If someone is not aware of a situation, or is not aware of a particular person that is involved in a communal fighting, this is where the problem is. You cannot tell anybody you don't have a link, a proper link, something that would link him or her into the cause of the conflict. That's where the problem is. And the government is bothered really by this. And I don't know why this report comes out all the time, current pace. I actually urge the writer of such reports to be very, very careful when writing their reports.
Ateim Wekate is the spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. International medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says healthcare facilities in Ethiopia's conflict-torn Tigray region have been attacked and looted, as Ethiopia's government and its allies have battled Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels since November. For more, viewers Jason Patinkin reached out to MSF Head of Emergency Programs, Marie Carmen Vignoles, in Addis Ababa. Vignoles has just returned to Addis Ababa from the conflict zone in Tigray.
I managed to visit the three projects where we are implementing activities, so basically in the area of Adigrat, the area of Aksum and Adwa, and as well the area of Abi Adi. So basically central Tigray and northeast Tigray. What I have seen, unfortunately, it's the people really, they are in desperate need of food, water, healthcare, name it. But what the thing that struck me most is that they live in fear. They have no hope, and they feel like abandoned. They have suffered a lot. They are suffering still a lot. And I just hope that all the humanitarian organizations, international organizations, and the government are able to scale up the humanitarian assistance that they desperately need.
Now, MSF made a statement that there has been destruction of healthcare facilities in Tigray. Does this look like it was accidental in the fighting or deliberate?
So it has been both. I mean, in all the wars, there are collateral damage. So in all the wars, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, the rocket is not falling where it's supposed to fall. But what we have seen, unfortunately, is that in a lot of occasions has been deliberate, the destruction and the looting. We have visited more than 100 different facilities, hospitals, health centers, health posts, more than 100, and only 1 out of 10 are functioning. And the reason is because most of them were damaged or they were looted. So they don't have anything. I mean, they don't have equipment. They don't have medicines. The few equipment that was left because it was not looted in many occasions was destroyed. And unfortunately as well, this looting is not only affecting the health facilities as well ambulances. So more than 80% of the ambulances that were available and they were doing these emergency referrals from rural places, very isolated into the hospitals, and they were functioning before the conflict. Nowadays, they have been stolen, so the referral system is not in place.
And that same statement mentions that some of the health facilities have been occupied by Eritrean soldiers and Ethiopian forces. Is that still ongoing?
Correct. In the past were Ethiopian forces and Eritrean forces. These are the areas that we have seen. Until recently, Ethiopian forces were occupying no hospital. They fortunately left some few weeks ago, which is very good. And nowadays, we still have, as far as we know, and we have visited 2 health facilities that they are occupied by Eritrean forces. It's not only the occupation, Jason, as well, what is very concerning. The looting is still ongoing. I visited one health center, and the community confirmed there was a looting 5 days ago. So this needs to stop.
That was Marie Carmen Vignoles, MSF Head of Emergency Programs. She was speaking with viewers Jason Patikin in Addis Ababa. Calm has returned to the Gambian fishing village of Sanya after rioters destroyed a police station and a Chinese fish meal factory. The incident was provoked by the alleged murder of one of the locals by a foreign national. Pandera Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Police fired tear gas on Monday to disperse angry villagers who were out to protest the killing of a resident of Sanyang village. Sanyang is on the coast about 43 kilometers southwest of the capital, Banjul. Ahmed Manjang, a Gambian environmentalist, describes what he saw.
I was just like maybe 10 meters away from the police station. It was still smoldering with smoke. It was burned down to ashes. And the Chinese steel factory in Sanya also is burned down to ashes. And few stores along the beach were all completely burned down to ashes. And the kids are on the rampage. Anything they feel that, you know, is going to harm the government, they go after it and burn it.
The riot was sparked by the death of a 25-year-old villager who allegedly was murdered by a West African national.
There was a break-in into a compound. These are compound belonged to an European, and the part of the Sanyang where this happened is called Bunkilin. So the next door neighbors who are keeping an eye on this compound went to find out. They discovered that there is somebody in the house. So when they got into the house, fight ensued, and this criminal or a criminal actually stabbed one of the brothers. There are two brothers, and unfortunately he died, but the other brother also sustained serious facial injuries and is now recovering in hospital.
Manjiang has accused the Chinese oil factory of pollution, a charge the owners have denied. He says tensions in the community have been building up before the death.
It's a build-up of frustration upon frustration. Chinese have a free one that they do whatever they want to do, and they're getting away with it. And then we have this fishing agreement with Senegal, which is where Senegalese can come in any number, any kind of net, fish in our ozone, sell their fish directly to the Chinese, ignoring the locals, you know, directly to the Chinese, and the Chinese are even paying them in CFA francs. The locals are seeing this. They feel that the country has been taken over by foreign national.
Ibrahim Asilla is Gambia's information minister.
The alleged culprit is currently under police custody, and the police will continue with their investigation until they are actually satisfied with the evidence before them, and then hopefully he will be, you know, arraigned before the courts.
He wouldn't comment about allegations of pollution by the factory, but said the government is serious about protecting the natural resources and would take action if there are issues with the factory. Silla says the riot caused significant property destruction, but that the situation is under control.
I think the police are actually doing their work. I don't know what will happen next. I mean, that will depend on the evidence at hand, but I can tell you that the situation is completely under control now.
The police have rounded up some of the protesters. Silla appealed to the villagers to be peaceful and respect the rule of law. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Ivory Coast on Monday began a week of mourning for Prime Minister Ahmed Bakayoko, who died last Wednesday in Germany. Journalist Felix Boni is in the Ivorian capital, Abidjan.
There was not any special activities this Monday instead of the reception of condolences at the familial home of the deceased. The funeral will begin clearly this Tuesday with the tribute of the nation and the political parties Tuesday, Wednesday, and after that, the next program will be the transfer of the soul to Segela in northwest of Cote d'Ivoire. This is the area, the origin area of the deceased.
What else is on the agenda for this week?
The agenda of the next week will be the group prayer of the Muslim, and after the group prayer of the Muslim, there will be the soul will be buried in the strict family privacy in the Segela, the village of the head of the government.
Felix, there were unconfirmed reports that the late Bakayoko may have been poisoned. Did the government say what he died from?
Yes, this is the opinion, a version given by to the population, and which has been spread in the population. And most of the Ivorians believe that Mr. Ahmed Bakayoko, the prime minister, has been poisoned. The government said that Mr. Ahmed Bakayoko is dead. This is the official version. He's dead from a cancerous cancer. We know that the prime minister was not ill until the month of January. And it is just in January, at about the final days of January, that he shows some sign of illness. And he went first in France to make a control, and he came back. And this February, he went February 18th to France again for this disease, and he went back deaf. So Ivorian, in the opinion of Ivorian, they think that the Prime Minister has been killed by poison.
That was journalist Felix Bolney speaking with us from the Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. And that's it for this Tuesday, March the 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Batty in Washington saying,